Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
All righty. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have an amazing founder, a founder that was born in Morocco, you know, and raised in Casablanca. And again, incredible story, you know, like he's done it all, not only on the founder side, also on the investment side. He's quite active. But again, building, scaling, financing, you know, also why healthcare is a tough space to really become an entrepreneur. Really the excitement too about Gen AI, you know, that wave that is right now out there, as well as, you know, why the cancer space. But again, you know, he's done it, you know, too, on building, scaling, and getting it all the way to the finish line as well. So we're going to be talking about the transactional side too. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Othman Laraki. Welcome to the show.
Alejandro, thank you for having me. Great to see you.
So originally born in Casablanca, Morocco, you know, and raised there. So how was life growing up in Morocco?
It's a wonderful place. I mean, one thing I always tell people is like, it's about Morocco is, and you know, I'm sure you've been there coming from Spain, is that it's really a place that's at the intersection of so many cultures and aspects of the world where, you know, it's a very, obviously it's known as an Arab and Muslim country, but it's also a very longstanding, you know, actually the majority of Moroccans are Berber, so kind of the original kind of inhabitants of the of Northwest Africa. Very strong, like Jewish influence, a very longstanding Jewish population, huge influence and interchange with Europe and sub-Saharan Africa. So it's a really kind of like, you know, blended, you know, country and community. And so it's always really fun to take people there. And so, yeah, growing up there was a really fun and interesting place. I mean, it just gives a lot of perspective, you know, when you experience different parts of the world. So yeah, it was a good place. I highly recommend visiting.
How do you get out of all things into computers being there in Morocco?
You know, my father was an entrepreneur his entire career and very into, like, you know, he's not technical by background, but he's kind of like a, you know, a bit of a nerd, like loved like new technology, et cetera. And I literally, you know, sometimes you have a memory as a kid, like of that stands out in your life. I must have been like maybe 6 or 7. And one day he walks in with a computer, like a brand that doesn't exist anymore called Amstrad. And it was a computer that still had like tape decks, you know, where, you know, you need to, you know, put a cassette tape to run a program. And in Morocco at the time, actually, you know, you couldn't buy the computer games. So I would get these magazines with the program written on them. So you'd have like 50 pages of computer code that you needed to type in to play a game. And so, you know, that was kind of my introduction to computers. And, you know, so that was kind of like, you know, the early introduction, and just kind of, it was, a great way to start learning and appreciate, you know, from the early days, you know, how all these pieces were coming together.
So typically, you know, in places like Spain or let's say Morocco, you know, what happens is that you stay with your parents all the way until you get married, you know, the good life, you know, there. But in your case, you know, at 18, you decided to pack up the bags and come to the U.S. That's quite a bold move.
Yeah, well, you know, also, I mean, I'm sure probably similar story for you. Like, it's not like I had a plan ahead, right? Like, it was what seemed like the right move at the time was, you know, I was really excited about, you know, engineering. And actually at the time I was actually more even thinking of going down the route in studying physics. But I was fortunate to get it into Stanford for undergrad. So at 18, I moved to the Bay Area. But it was right when the internet, the first internet wave was happening. So 1996. And so happened to land here and be interested in computers at this, you know, incredible moments in time where, you know, I remember like you know, meeting, you know, Jerry Yang, you know, who had just started Yahoo, few weeks into being an undergrad, and, you know, Larry and Sergey from Google were doing their PhDs there at the time. And, actually I got into running this, entrepreneurship speaker series, after my first year there. And a professor I worked with, called Tom Kosnick, he gave me the name of this, like, he's like, you know, this Japanese entrepreneur, he's really interesting. You should try to invite him. And it was Masa from SoftBank. You know, this was like 96, 97, where, you know, he was still at the beginning of his journey. But it's like, it was this, just incredible moment in time to, you know, see all these people who, you know, would change the, you know, the industry, create the industry, not just change it, but create it. So it was a really interesting moment to be there. But yeah, so I mean, at the time, I mean, I had no real plans around how long I'd be in here or whether I'd go back or not for my career. But, you know, just, you know, being in the Bay Area and, you know, Silicon Valley is just such an amazing place to build new companies. So that's kind of where I've stayed since then.
Now, in your case, you know, when you're in Stanford, as you were saying, you're like surrounded by innovation. Instead of like starting a company, which is what you would do, the ramen noodles, you know, and all that stuff right after college. In your case, you decided to become a software engineer and you actually worked for several companies. Eventually, how did that moment come of you coming up with the idea of Epitrope, you know, which was your first company?
Yeah, you know, so, you know, really the genesis of that was, it was at the end of my undergrad at Stanford. And, you know, there's, you know, the fork that I think a lot of software engineers have, which is, do you join a bigger company or, and actually at the time, you know, the Google was just getting started and, you know, I knew Larry and Sergey, and I later joined Google, but at the time I was like, you know, who needs another search engine? You know, there's already Yahoo and Excite, et cetera. So I was like, you know, I'll just start my own thing. and so we just kind of collected like a group of some of the smartest people we knew and just started meeting up every, you know, just spending time in the same building and, you know, hacking different software ideas. And that was the genesis of Epitrope, the first company. And at the time where we really focused was on mobile. We thought mobile internet was going to be a big deal. So this is 2000. It turned out, you know, in the big scheme of things, it was the wrong timing. we were fortunate to get connected with a Japanese company called Access Systems, which had built the browser and the kind of infrastructure for the iMode in Japan. And so we still ended up getting a really interesting mobile internet experience. But it was, you know, years before the iPhone and at the time where the industry was still completely locked up. And, you know, I think one of the lessons from that, frankly, was also like sometimes, you know, a right idea at the wrong time is kind of indistinguishable from just the wrong idea altogether. You know, at the time it was just like so difficult to build something and, make it accessible to people. So, it was definitely an interesting journey, but, we ended up spending a lot of good time in Japan, but it was, definitely too early for its time, I think.
And then from there to, MIT. But hey, once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. So why joining Google instead of like maybe trying it again?
Yeah, you know, like, so when I was finishing off at MIT, like the, by then, I mean, almost everyone I knew had joined Google. It was at the time when, you know, Google was about a bit under 1,000 people, you know, and by then it was clear that it was this incredible platform where it was on this huge ascendancy and was, you know, it was also a window of time where it's like almost the honeymoon phase with the media and the world, et cetera, where everyone just like loved Google. Google had like almost infinite resources. And for someone who enjoys building, you know, it was a time where you could kind of show up and as long as you were building interesting products and interested in spending all of your time and headspace trying to innovate, the environment was almost perfect for it. And so for someone as a builder, it was just, you know, being in a candy shop. So, so I joined Google in 2004, and I mean, it was a wonderful window of time where, still this kind of Cambrian era where it's like, there's just like so many new things to build. Like, you know, the entire space was growing so rapidly. So, so those were some really, really good years.
So from the time there, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, like that was the time where incredible people, I mean, still incredible talent, you know, were there at Google. But I've met so many people that were actually in Google during those years and have gone out and created incredible companies. So how was the atmosphere, the culture, the people that you were surrounded by during those years at Google?
Yeah, you know, like one of the interesting memories, I mean, I remember from that is like, it was literally several years where I did not remember a single offer we made that didn't get taken for hiring someone. Like, you know, it was because I mean, keep in mind too, right? Like, you know, the internet bubble happened, massive growth, then the internet bubble popped. And I mean, it was the Bay Area was like, you know, a war zone, right? Like, you know, I remember, driving down, in my kind of prior startup, down Highway 237, which goes by Cisco and all the semiconductor companies close to San Jose, I used to have like a 40-minute drive to work. And with all of the layoffs, it was actually similar to COVID when they shut everything down. It was like 45-minute drive went down to about 15 minutes because all of these companies had laid off so many people, right? Like, so it was a, you know, coming off a window of time where everyone was like, okay, the internet is over. This was overhyped. You know, all this idea of, you know, a new era coming was really just kind of a bunch of, you know, BS. Pack up and go home, go back to McKinsey or whatever. and so you had this like, and then when Google like really kind of started exploding, it was, I think, the reopening of optimism and of access and scale. And I think what happened there is that, you know, Google was also, you know, was founded by, you know, a pair of super nerds who brought in all of their super nerd friends and did an amazing job hiring all these people from Bell Labs and from all these, you know, deeply academic and deeply intellectual, but like very like software engineering, like purists in a way. And so it was this place where, you know, you had this kind of combination of incredible, like, economic resources, but also incredible, like, intellectual talent that, you know, just made it possible to have this level of ambition that, I mean, I have not witnessed since. I mean, there have been, like, many other incredible companies obviously created since then and so on, but, like, that window of time of that combination of at scale of, I mean, intensity and willingness to, you know, take on, like, I mean, even right now, like, you know, everyone is used to, like, now with hyperscalers thinking of, like, oh, you know, you have, you know, data centers with hundreds of thousands of machines, et cetera. I mean, at the time, the scale at which Google was pushing things was, like, literally unheard of, right? Like, it was, you'd show up inside and you'd be like, wait, someone made an error. They're like two extra zeros on everything that you're doing. right. Like, you know, I remember like, you know, some, you know, early machine learning models that were working on, you know, a million parameters, which at the time would, you know, like now it seems like, you know, quaint, but at the time was like, just, you know, seemed to defy logic. Right. And so that was like, just kind of this really, interesting moment, right? Like where you can be like, okay, like if it's technically possible, we can actually do it. And so it, you know, so like things like, you know, the genesis of, you know, Android or Chrome, or even products like Gmail and Google Maps, right? Like where you could think of, it's like, oh, we're going to go and map the entire world, right? Like now that seems like, oh, it's been done. It's, in retrospect, it seems easy, but at the time it was like, these things that looked like, you know, moon landing style endeavors. I mean, kind of the stuff that now we experience when we see like, you know, a SpaceX, you know, booster landing, right? Like it was that kind of type of like technical achievements that was happening in a routinely in a way. And that was kind of a pretty unique window of time, I think.
Now, after that, you decided to go at it again and you started Mixer Labs, which ended up being the second acquisition by Twitter. So how was it like that journey too? And in this case, having an acquisition by a company that ended up becoming a household, no? Everyone knows about Twitter, now X.
Yeah. You know, so, you know, with Mixer Labs, we had started off in the geo space. So this was right when, you know, when the, like, this is when the iPhone and Android started supporting the GPS API. So like, you know, people forget, right? Like at the beginning, mobile phones did not know about location. And so there were all these kind of early mobile attempts at doing geo-based applications. Like actually Sam Altman's first startup, a company called Looped, you know, used to do all these things to try to do triangulation with cell towers and all this complicated stuff. And all of a sudden mobile phones, you know, added into the standard API, you know, just a GPS API, which is actually one of the things I worked on at Google before leaving. But like all of a sudden it became like this one API call and you can get a phone's location. And that opened up like a whole new kind of wave of like, oh, what does it look like to build applications that are aware of location? And, you know, we were building kind of the infrastructure to be able to build these applications. And Twitter, you know, started off, one of the big arcs behind it was this kind of hyper-local, you know, instantaneous community dynamic. And so we joined in part because of that, like, you know, goal for Twitter to build kind of a more kind of like geo-based local service. In practice, you know, if you remember at the time, the fail whale days where Twitter was down half of the time, et cetera. And the team from Mixer Labs was this like really, really, really strong like engineering team. And in practice, what we really ended up doing, most of the value we created was much less related to geo stuff, but much more around helping build the Twitter infrastructure. So how you build and release the software so the system doesn't crash. How do you get Twitter into a much more stable data center? Like that was actually, I ran the project of getting Twitter into multi-data center mode so you can have it be distributed and, you know, not crash all the time and run in a production data center and so on. So we ended up actually doing much more like systems work. So deep in the infrastructure. And actually a lot of that, I think, still lives to today. And you know, I mean, it's one of those, again, like similar to the Google journey, but, you know, we were fortunate to be there at a time when it was just like this explosive growth rate. Like it was, you know, from when we joined, it might've been like about 15 or so million users to almost a quarter billion users by the time I left. And so that was, again, like one of those, you know, really interesting, you know, fun windows of time where also like, I mean, Twitter was also such a, unlike Google, I think Twitter was also a very social phenomenon. Like, you know, I had never been in a social company, like, you know, Google's a very nerdy company. And Twitter was really a much more of a, it's almost a social company that happened to do technology. And so, you know, we'd have like people like, you know, Lady Gaga would come visiting, or Erdogan came to our office one time, or Medvedev, you know, one time, you know, it's like, I remember driving into the parking lot, going up the elevator, and there's these huge guys. And like, it's like, what's going on? And there's like these, you know, these like guys that look like, you know, closets. And it's like, oh, they're like, you know, security detail. It's like, oh yeah, Medvedev is in the building. Wow. You know, it was just this kind of interesting company because like it was still very small, but like was at the intersection of society experiencing technology. I mean, also it was during like the Arab Spring, for example, right? Like, you know, and, you know, being kind of Moroccan and growing up in North Africa, right? Like, it was very interesting to you know, for to be there during the Arab Spring and seeing the effect that Twitter was having on, or not effect. I think in some ways that was overplayed, but I feel almost like Twitter was one of the tools through which society, you know, changed pretty fundamentally, I think. And so that was kind of an interesting time. I mean, I do also, I mean, one thing that's kind of also interesting in that when you think back, right, like I remember having this anxiety and actually discussing and debating this with Jack at the time, which is very topical to today, which is when you step back, you know, and you think about the effect of social media on society, right? Like the, you know, we were building this kind of, and us and obviously Facebook and Instagram, et cetera, but like we were building these tools that I think changed the fabric of how information and relationships flow across human societies. And obviously no one has a playbook because all these things are happening, you know, for the first time. But one of the things I remember being very anxious about is that in this world, new world that we were kind of all participating in, that the like truth or accuracy does not have a competitive advantage. If you think of information propagation as almost like a survival or a natural selection process, you know, and you ask, okay, like, you know, over time and, you know, even historically, right, like how ideas and religions or beliefs and so on propagate, and what are the dynamics that enable an idea to be believed by a lot of people? We were deeply changing the substrate along which that was happening. And in that environment, if you say, okay, I have one piece of information that's true information and one piece that's like made up, the made up information actually has a competitive advantage in that it's not encumbered by reality, right? Like, and the, you know, this new world that we were all kind of, now we're all living in, right? Like, there is no competitive advantage to accurate information or to truth or to kind of like, in some ways, and that, you know, it's not like I have a better answer, but it's like, it was kind of an interesting dynamic that we were already grappling with at the time that frankly, it's still, you know, very much an issue, right? Like where, you know, we have not, I think, succeeded yet at making, you know, even the definition of truth, I think, has gotten really, you know, questioned in a pretty fundamental way, in part thanks because of all these tools. And so, you know, so it's kind of, I mean, I think Twitter was just like a very interesting company, from that respect, right? Like, and, you know, or just participated in a very kind of interesting, like, social phenomenon, I find. So,
hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
And how do you go from being in that social phenomenon, you know, kind of environment, to all of a sudden deciding to take on healthcare?
Yeah. It was like many decisions. It was not necessarily thought out or deliberate. It was kind of sometimes, you know, the opportunities and the, you know, challenges find you. And, the root of it was my co-founder in Mixer Labs, and he was, we worked together. We were, you know, close friends from the Google days. This guy, Elad Gil, who's, you know, very active investor and, you know, has been kind of a partner and, or kind of, in this journey. We were both at Twitter because we started Mixer Labs. We were there together. And, but he had a biology background. So he had also been at MIT, but he had been a biology PhD. And this was the early days of genetics. And he got his genome sequence and he brought it on a hard drive. And I remember we were sitting on the terrace at Twitter and he just kind of, you know, handed me his hard drive to, like, you know, go and play with it. And so I kind of went and started, like, just kind of like learning about genetic information, et cetera. And, you know, one thing that kind of like, as we started kind of like exploring the data, it struck us that there was this kind of wave, what looked like a wave that was coming of genetics information getting very, very accessible and cheap. But the software, it's fundamentally a place where healthcare and data kind of intersect. And it was striking to us that there was no good software to be able to really analyze and understand genetics. And so really initially I kind of like started my journey in healthcare more with a software hat, being like, oh, there's a lot of data coming into healthcare. And, you know, it seemed like the software infrastructure for it was still pretty, you know, nascent. And so got interested that way. There was another connection to me personally, which is that, so my grandmother had passed away from breast cancer. My mother is a two-time breast cancer survivor. And we discovered that she has a mutation in a gene called BRCA2, BRCA2, which I also carry. It's actually relevant to you, Alejandro. It's a Spanish mutation because her mother was Spanish. It's originated in Spain. And I'm a carrier of this mutation as well, which increases people's risk of different cancers. And so I got also really interested personally initially from that intersection of genetics and cancer, but also what it means to be able to use this data to help people's health in a proactive way. And so that was really the beginning, really. And, you know, so I started in healthcare, not knowing anything about the industry, right? Like just being interested in the science and the technology. You know, obviously it's been now a 11, 12 year journey in with Color, where I've learned a lot about the healthcare industry as an entrepreneur. But it's a very, very different, you know, industry, I think, than anything else that, you know, I'd encountered before. And so
why do you think it's so tough? What do you think healthcare is so tough for entrepreneurs as an industry to innovate in?
Yeah, you know, whenever I meet like a, you know, tech nerd like me and who's thinking about, you know, everyone gets excited by healthcare because it's a huge industry and it's like a lot of opportunities for impact and problems to solve. You know, one thing I always tell people as a disclaimer is like in the game of entrepreneurship, it's like dialing the difficulty level to 11 and tying hand behind your back. It's like, you know, it's definitely one of the hardest, I think, places to be an entrepreneur, especially as a technologist. A lot of people think that the reason for that is because of regulation. I actually don't think that's right. I think the reason why healthcare is such a difficult industry is that it is a deeply kind of monopolistically kind of constrained industry. When you look at how the market works in healthcare and how money flows, it is an extremely illiquid market where if you build a product and you're like, you know, in most other industries, you know, whether in SaaS or in, you know, as a consumer, et cetera, you build a product. And if it's a way better product that's much cheaper, you have an open marketplace to compete in and you can gain market share relatively rapidly just on the direct competition. Whereas in healthcare, the way to think about it is like all of the money, like the vast majority of the money in healthcare is in the US especially, is like pooled with insurance companies that then funnel where the money and how the money flows. And what the business model that most insurance companies fundamentally adopt is not really about being better at managing people's health and making a margin, competing on quality of healthcare. It's really about taking the rents and the margin out of the clinical services. And so when you think about as a product builder, if you're at the service layer, it is a very difficult competition to be able to build something and have a strategy that where you can actually access the market and extract the value that you create, right? Which is what most functioning markets provide. And so I think that's what makes healthcare very, very difficult, is that it's fundamentally, I mean, when you look at like, I mean, as a someone with both tech and healthcare, when I look at all the antitrust stuff happening right now with talks about breaking up Google, et cetera, I mean, it is, to me, it is unbelievable that it's like, we're not like, if there's a real deregulation or antitrust problem in the US economy, it is number one is healthcare, whether it's the payers, the PBMs, where, you know, you look at, you know, the fact that a company like United Health Group is a Fortune 5 company. It's not because they're good at healthcare, it's because they're good at extracting the rents of healthcare. And that is, I think, where there is like the, and it, you know, and that's on 20% of our economy, right? Like it is, the amount of cost in the system is so much bigger in that than anything that, you know, a Google or an Amazon, et cetera. I'm not gonna, there might be antitrust kind of questions there, but like, I think it is way, way bigger in healthcare actually than any other industry.
So for the people that are listening to get it, what ended up being the business model of Color? How are you guys making money?
Yeah, so, you know, we iterated a lot. Like, so we pivoted the number of times, and we've had, I'll actually tell you where we are now and kind of, I can also walk through how we got there, but over time we evolved into this vertically integrated care delivery company where, so we run a 50-state medical group, so we can actually practice, we actually run with doctors, we run healthcare programs. We also run a diagnostics infrastructure and laboratories so that we can actually provide testing that we run ourselves and process. And we have software and systems around it. And so what we sell are these big population programs to big buyers, whether it's in government like the NIH or to big employers. So right now, the main core of Color's business is we run the country's first 50-state virtual cancer clinic, which is a rethinking of how you manage cancer for large populations. So our main customers today are big employers like, large companies, whether it's like, you know, tech companies like Salesforce or big unions like the Teamsters, like truck driver unions, or pension funds. And what we do is like for them, healthcare is the, after salaries, is the number one operating cost for most of these big populations. And cancer is about 15 to 20% of total cost of care. So, you know, you can think of cancer, it's almost 3% of US GDP. It's like, it's, we spend more on cancer than we do like on like, probably like defense, or it's like, it's such a huge, huge industry. And today cancer is completely unmanaged, right? Like where, you know, cancer, people get diagnosed, late stage cancers cost like $250,000 each, and we don't even necessarily do a great job at saving people's lives. And so what we did is we built this virtual cancer clinic that says like, how do you, from all the way from screening, like catching cancers early, to managing someone when they're diagnosed, through treatments, all the way through survivorship, a modern age rethinking of how do you do that at a national level. For these very big distributed populations, because when you think of a big company or a big like union across the US, they have people all over the place. So you can't just serve them in San Francisco or Atlanta, right? Like you have to be able to serve people across dozens of cities and so on. And so that's what we do. So that's what we sell, is a way to take control of cancer and deliver better outcomes for people.
And how much capital have you guys raised to date? And then also, how has it been the journey of going through the financing rounds too?
Yes. So we've raised about $350 million over the company's life. We've been fortunate as like in the several of the things we've done over time, this model is actually extremely capital efficient. And so for a number of the programs that we've ran over time, they're very cash flow positive. So actually right now, all the capital that Color has is actually not from fundraising, but more from our own cash flows. But where, for example, we run a lot of the services for a million person program with the NIH called the All of Us program. Or during COVID, for example, we ran a lot of the public health testing or vaccination programs across the country. And this model allows us to both give services that are very inexpensive and equitable, but also very cash flow positive. And so we were fortunate that we had really good backing from investors early on, but now have been primarily running on cash that the company has generated over time. And so, but in terms of fundraising, I mean, you know, fundraising in healthcare is generally more challenging, I think, than AI or any of these, because like it is just a more difficult industry. It's like it is more difficult to generate great returns compared to, you know, capital light, very high multiple industries. Like fundamentally, when you look at multiples in healthcare, they're much lower than, you know, SaaS companies, for example. And so, you know, that generally makes it a harder game to play, but obviously much bigger impact, you know, in people's lives. And, you know, and it is, you know, obviously a very, very large industry.
So obviously, you know, I'd like to ask you this one. If you go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of Color is fully realized, what does that world look like?
And what it looks like is, you know, when you think about the services or like the access to healthcare today to keep you healthy or deal with problems when they arise, you know, like you probably, you know, I'm not sure how old you are, Alejandro, but like, you know, say you turn 45 and you need the to start getting colonoscopies, or that you need to get tested for prostate cancer risk. Today, your experience is that, you know, you need to find a primary care doctor, go see them so they can give you a referral. You go to a lab to get a test, or go to, you know, to get, there are all these hoops that you need to jump through. And imagine you live in New York, but say you lived 100 miles from New York. That means like traveling, et cetera, and oftentimes spending money out of pocket. First of all, the vision behind what we do is like you get top quality expertise that does all this work for you in the background, where you just automatically get scheduled for the things that you need to keep you healthy. If ever you get a diagnosis, instead of you waiting for multiple months to see an oncologist and for treatment to start, et cetera, as soon as diagnosis happens, all the next steps that need to be taken care of are already done for you automatically. So for example, actually, we have a partnership with OpenAI. We built this product called the Cancer Copilot that we use right now, where as soon as someone gets diagnosed, we can immediately start preparing them for treatments instead of waiting multiple weeks. And these things have like sometimes like make a 10, 20% change in probability that you survive the cancer. And so I think like my vision or our vision for healthcare is that science, there's all these amazing things that science establishes. But when you look at the practical reality of the care that people get, it's very far below. You know, to give you just one concrete example, today the highest mortality cancer in the US is lung cancer. A lot of it driven by smoking. If someone has a lot of smoking history, they should get an annual lung CT past the age of 50. Today, 94% of people who should get a lung cancer screen do not get it. And it's not because they're dumb. It's not because it's expensive. It's not because they don't want to do it. It's because it's a pain in the ass. It is very, like, it's a, like, you need to jump through a bunch of hoops. You need to pay out of pocket. It's inconvenient and so on. Closing that gap, literally getting lung cancer, people at lung cancer risk to get their annual screenings, would have a bigger impact on cancer mortality than any cancer drug that has ever been put on the market in the history of cancer, right? That is the, and that's the difference between the science and the lived reality. And it's just an access problem. It's literally a simplicity and convenience and transactional efficiency problem. Not, it's, so it's a market problem, not a scientific or medical problem. So I think that's the gap, you know, the opportunity to close. And that's what really excites me about the intersection of technology is like, I think, you know, what things like AI and like, you know, just general digital health, et cetera, does is that is not that it completely changes the nature of science, is that it blows up old business models and allows new ones to exist, right? Like where things that we used to think of as being expensive and being inconvenient or scarce become abundance, right? Like to you and me today, right? Like if I need to talk with an expert in prostate cancer, it'll take hours of time and weeks or months of delay to be able to have that interaction. I think what technology can do is make that a 5-second or a 10-second overhead to get that level of expertise, to make that level of expertise accessible. So I think that's really kind of the opportunity. And obviously, again, it's like a very, very hard thing to achieve. So, I'm not deluding myself, but I think that's the you know, the potential.
So you're three companies in now, Othman. So if I could bring you back in time, you know, to that point where you were like walking around the campus in Stanford and thinking about a world of starting your own company and becoming an entrepreneur. If you were able to show up there and have a chat with your younger self, and you were able to give that younger self one piece of advice for launching a company, what would that be and why, given what you know now?
It's a great question. I mean, I think, first of all, I won't say the obvious things that are based on just like pure market hindsight, right? Like it's kind of like, oh, you know, join Google, you know,
yeah.
Things like that, that, you know, it's like, I mean, a few things. And, you know, I think one thing that's been actually very is like, that you learn as an entrepreneur is that balance between selling and not lying. I think, you know, it's something that I've had kind of almost like I'd always stuck to that kind of principle, but I think having more confidence around that, like I think you realize over time is that, you know, as an entrepreneur, you need to sell a vision and sell the future to people and convince them of a reality that doesn't exist yet, but you want to achieve. And I think it's super important to be your own, filter or kind of ensuring that you stay on the right side of not overpromising. And, you know, I feel proud of the not having stayed on the right side, I think, of that over time. But I think it is also very difficult as a starting entrepreneur to have that confidence. And so that's something that I think is very important. I think number two, frankly, is like by far, and people always say this, but like, you know, the quality of the people you surround yourself with and the, you know, when you find, you know, I think through our career, all of us oftentimes have are fortunate to run into truly phenomenal people that, and it's not just based on status. It's like oftentimes it's not like the most famous person or successful person, but rather you run into exceptional people. And, you know, and I, you know, not missing every opportunity you can to, you know, stay close to them and do work with them and learn from them and so on. I think those are some of the, you know, core lessons. Actually, maybe the last one I would put in is that in hindsight, everyone talks about grit and about, you know, sticking to it, et cetera. I think one of the things that I feel, especially every startup I feel I've learned more and more is that, you know, there's a difference between, you know, intensity, determination and focus, but also learning from the signals that you're getting from the world. I think as a young entrepreneur, at least that was my case, I feel I had a lot of ego and a lot of, you know, I felt like people who disagreed with my idea, et cetera, I took that personally. And, you know, and I still do a little to some extent, but like, but oftentimes you realize that, you know, most people, like 99% of people around the world, like really have no agenda to offend you or to be in your way. And people's reactions and the reaction you get from the world and the market is extremely valuable signal. And it's really worthwhile to really, as much as you can, try to incorporate that. And it doesn't mean just like, again, like follow the wind blowing every which way, but to not dismiss the signal that you're getting as people just being stupid or just not getting it. If they're not getting it, it's your problem. It's your fault. And I, you know, I think as a young entrepreneur, I felt like, at least for me, and you know, I'm sure it's shared by others, but like it's hard to dissociate yourself from your ideas. I feel that's actually like, you know, the more I learn over time, the more comfortable I get with pivoting and updating my beliefs in a more nimble way. And I think that's actually one of the things that experience gives, is actually it's not about being right earlier for the first time. I think you get much more turns of the clock because you learn a lot more quickly, I think, from what you see. And so I feel that's one of the biggest lessons.
So for the people that are listening, Othman, I would love to reach out and say hi. What is the best way for them to do so?
Actually, the easiest way is on Twitter. My Twitter handle is just Othman, with my first name, Twitter. My DMs are open, so feel free to DM me. You can also reach out to me on LinkedIn. My SLA on LinkedIn is much worse. But on Twitter, it's very easy to reach me. I guess I should get used to calling it X, but yeah.
Amazing. Well, hey, Othman, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thank you for having me. Real pleasure to connect, and drop me a line next time you're in the Bay Area.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.